Today on Straight Talk Africa, U.S. President Barack Obama delivered his final State of the Union address last night, outlining his domestic and foreign policy agenda for the last year of his presidency and beyond. How will his foreign policy impact Africa? That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. It's Wednesday, January 13th. I am Shaka Salih.
Well, hello to you, Shaka, and hello to all our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Mariama Diallo, your social media reporter.
Today, we'll reflect on last night's State of the Union address by U.S. President Barack Obama, the last of his presidency, and its significance for Africa.
Well, it was quite a night, and some of us had very little sleep trying to cover all angles of the speech last night. Well, coming up later in our STA inbox, we'll share your thoughts on the topic through your emails, tweets, and Facebook comments. That's ahead on Straight Talk Africa. Hope you'll stay with us.
But first, President Obama delivered his seventh and final State of the Union address Tuesday, telling both houses of Congress to look ahead, not just at the next year, but 5 years and beyond. VOA's Karen Prasuti has more.
In his final State of the Union, the man who promised hope spoke of the nation as clear-eyed, big-hearted, and optimistic, yet now unnerved by terrorism.
When you come after Americans, we go after you.
Despite attacks in Paris and California, Obama said foreign and homegrown terrorists are deadly, but do not threaten the nation's existence. Yet he urged the Republican Congress to act.
If this Congress is serious about winning this war and wants to send a message to our troops and the world, authorize the use of military force against ISIL. Take a vote.
The president also asked Congress to take the next step on Cuba and lift the trade embargo. And in the Pacific, he asked for approval of the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. Shortly before the speech, 10 American sailors on two patrol boats like these were detained by Iran. The president did not mention the incident, even as he touted the Iran nuclear agreement before skeptics in Congress.
As we speak, Iran has rolled back its nuclear program, shipped out its uranium stockpile, and the world has avoided another war.
South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley gave the Republican Party response, envisioning a White House under different management.
We would make international agreements that were celebrated in Israel and protested in Iran, not the other way around.
On the president's requests, Republican pollster Matt Gammon.
I don't think he expects serious action on any of those items coming out of this Congress in particular, but I think he wants it to be seen, that he cares about these things to the people who will be writing his legacy in the future.
The president said he regrets the nation's continuing political divide and criticized negative comments by Republicans.
All the talk of America's economic decline is political hot air.
Meanwhile, on Twitter, Republican presidential candidates responded, Donald Trump calling the Obama speech lethargic, Ted Cruz dubbing it a state of denial, not a state of the union. The political message the White House hoped to deliver was for Americans to look past the Republican rhetoric and to focus on issues that will affect future generations. Americans vote on a new president in 10 months. In Washington, Carolyn Prasuti, VOA News.
Thanks, Caroline, for that report. Now, for more on last night's speech, I am joined by my colleague Jim Malone, Voice of America's national correspondent. Good afternoon, Jim.
Hello, Shaka.
How are you?
Fine, sir. How are you?
A happy new year to you, by the way, Joe.
And the same Jim. To you.
Yeah, talk to me about the speech last night. What is your reaction to the speech, really?
You know, what I really heard a lot of, Shaka, was a president who's very much aware of the political campaign going on in this country to succeed him. Especially the rhetoric coming from the Republican presidential candidates. Much of that is based on a negative narrative of the Obama administration. It starts with national security and fears of terrorism, but also goes to our national economy, the need to bolster wages in this country, and to have a brighter sort of outlook on the future. I think the president wanted to weigh in on the campaign and remind voters that the way he sees things, the administration has achieved a lot over the past 7 years, can achieve more before he leaves office, and basically wanted to counter what he sees as a very kind of negative doom and gloom picture that a lot of the Republican contenders, especially people like Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, have been portraying as to where the country is at the moment.
How was the speech received by the House? I heard, of course, people clapping and what have you, but was it, in fact, the whole House, or was it perhaps the fellow Democrats doing that?
Well, I think it broke down quite a bit along party lines, and that's no surprise. We've seen that happen for years. I was struck toward the end of the speech, the president, who's been in office for 7 years, deciding to focus on the political divide. He said, we need to fix our politics. Our politics are broken. This is something that's obviously been going on in this country for decades. He'd like to offer up some ways to get at that, the issue of money in politics, the corrosive nature of negative rhetoric, etc. But whether that's very realistic in a presidential election year, that's really open to question. And the fact is, Shaka, that the longer this election year goes on, I think Mr. Obama may recede into the background a bit. It's going to be about the people who want to succeed him, both Republicans and Democrats. And again, I think Barack Obama wants to make everyone clear that he still believes he has a voice in this, and he's going to speak out when he feels compelled to do so.
Now, Jim, you have covered those State of the Union addresses, in fact, perhaps all of the previous six. How does this compare, for example, with the previous one?
You know what I was really struck by was he invoked the early parts of his political career. And he actually said one of the regrets he's had as president, he was not able to sort of heal our political divide. He tried to conjure up, I think, that candidate Barack Obama we saw in Iowa in 2007 and 2008, who wanted to bring the country together, who wanted to be sort of a symbolic leader for national unity. He realizes that was a perhaps tougher nut to crack than he thought it was going to be. So most of the State of the Union addresses have to do with a list of policy proposals and what he'd like Congress to do. This was much more thematic, looking back, but also trying to look ahead. I think Democrats, his supporters, probably liked it a great deal. I think Republicans probably saw it as, you know, past the point of relevance, and they're already focused so much on the 2016 election and who will succeed Barack Obama as the 45th president.
What about some African critics who have been saying that they really expected the president to say something about, for example, democracy, you know, as far as the continent is concerned?
Well, I guess I understand where they're coming from. I mean, I was paying careful attention to the references to Africa in the State of the Union address. I think I counted about three. One had to do with Ebola in West Africa and the fight there to save lives. Also, of course, continuing threats of fears of terrorism that involve sort of failed states in Africa and the desire to counter the narrative presented by extremist groups. And, of course, efforts to help defeat poverty and disease in Africa. Something that we heard, by the way, from the previous president as well, George W. Bush. So my sense is that Barack Obama will always be a favorite son of Africa. There's no way around it. But, you know, as to what was actually accomplished on his watch for U.S. African policy, that's an open-ended debate, I suppose.
Well, thank you very much, Jim, for your insight.
Thank you.
Now, joining us here in our Washington studios are two distinguished guests. Karen Bass, Democrat from California, serves in the U.S. House of Representatives. Ms. Bass is the ranking Democrat on the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Africa, Global Health and Human Rights, and Ambassador Bruce Wharton, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Well, I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thanks for having us.
You're most welcome, and a happy new year to you, by the way.
Same to you.
Same to you. Thanks.
You're most welcome. Later in the program, we'll give you, the audience, a chance to call and talk with our guests. The number to call is 202-619-3111, and U.S. country code is 1. Let me come back to you immediately, Karen. You were there, of course.
I was.
Your reaction?
Well, it was a very inspiring and exciting night. And as your previous guest mentioned, it was interesting. There were lots of applause, lots of standing ovations, but it did break down in a partisan way. But I saw the speech as a look forward. Mm-hmm. The president centered the speech around four central themes, and it was a look to the future. And I do think that he talked about the last 7 years of his administration, but in a way he laid out a roadmap for us to move into the future.
He also talked about how, for example, the United States is the most powerful nation on Earth,
yes,
period. Not even close. Not even close. Mm-hmm. What did he exactly mean by that?
Well, I think he was directly referencing a lot of the rhetoric that has taken place on the campaign trail, which is beginning to paint a picture of the United States as though we're in trouble. We might be falling apart. It's gloom and doom. And I think he was essentially reorienting folks to the reality that the United States is the most powerful country on the planet. And even though the United States is vulnerable, like every other nation on the planet, to terrorist attacks, that those terrorist attacks that have hit our nation, most recently in San Bernardino, are not in any way destabilizing the entire country. I think that's the point that he was trying to make.
Did you get the sense that he connected with the average Joe, the average American citizen?
Well, you know, I certainly hope so, because if you, again, listen to the campaign trail, you mm-hmm. do feel like everything is beginning to fall apart. And I think it's important that people not lock into that rhetoric. So I believe it probably made people sit up and go, well, that's right, of course we're the strongest country in the world.
Very interesting. What about you, Bruce? What about you from your vantage point? You are an Africanist in the Department, in fact, of African Affairs at the State Department.
No, I thought the three references to Africa in the president's speech, though brief, were very important. The first one deals with our need to work with partners in Africa to combat the threat of extremism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's about our imperative, not just our imperative to protect our citizens, but our imperative to be good citizens on the planet and to use the resources we've got when we must. The second one was a reference to Ebola and the work done with African partners and international partners. That illustrates the importance of a cooperative, collaborative approach to large problems such as the outbreak of disease. The third reference was to helping African nations feed their families, feed their people. And I think that relates to our fundamental values as Americans. We want to do the right thing. So I thought those three references were quite important.
When you make reference to fighting extremism, obviously you're talking about groups such as Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, and Lord's Resistance Army, and you name it. Any particular reason, for example, why he did not name any of the three?
Well, again, I think Congresswoman Bass has talked about the importance of us putting these things into perspective. These are not existential threats to the United States. So to some extent, naming them gives them a credibility that that we'd rather not always do.
What about some observers, in fact, who have been saying that the reason you have groups such as Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab is because of leadership deficit on the continent?
I think the conditions that gave rise to Boko Haram and to Al-Shabaab predate the existence of both of those organizations. They relate to lack of opportunity. They relate to concern about a lack of faith in central authority, corruption, lack of education. So ultimately, in my view, the response to these groups is going to be to help generate more development, more opportunities for people in those parts of Africa.
What about you, Karen? There are people who have been saying, frankly, that when we talk about groups such as Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, and what have you, we are basically dealing with the symptom.
Mm-hmm.
That's frankly mm-hmm. what needs to be targeted are the conditions on the ground.
Well, I think that's absolutely correct. And I think the ambassador's reference to the conditions that existed before those groups had even risen is where we need to focus. So I think it's, you know, it's the corruption, it's weak governments, it's a lack of social services, education system, et cetera. It's the systemic reasons. And I do think that attention needs to be focused there.
Well, now we'll pause for a short break and would like to remind you that Straight Talk Africa is now on the social networking website Twitter. And we are tweeting live. Follow us at VOA Shaka. That's VOA Shaka. And join in on today's discussion with your questions and comments. Don't forget to use the hashtag VOASOTU or SOTU. And we are still on Facebook. Just enter the keyword Straight Talk Africa. Become a fan and connect with other friends of the Voice of America. We'll be right back with you, so please, don't go away.
The U.S. Constitution requires a yearly State of the Union message, but it doesn't mandate that the president delivers it verbally. President Thomas Jefferson discontinued delivering the address in person to Congress, simply forwarding his comments on paper to the House and Senate. Prior to Jefferson, Presidents George Washington and John Adams read their annual addresses to Congress. In 1913, President Woodrow Wilson restarted the tradition of delivering the address in person.
Like Voice of America on Facebook. Follow VOA on Twitter. Join VOA on our YouTube channel. Like, follow, join VOA.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. What is your opinion about today's topic? Call us at 202-619-3111. U.S. country code 1. When you call, remember the following. Ask only one question. Keep your comment brief and turn down the volume on your radio or television. Now let's return to Straight Talk Africa.
When we help African countries feed their people and care for the sick, it's the right thing to do, and it prevents the next pandemic from reaching our shores. You know, right now we're on track to end the scourge of HIV/AIDS. That's within our grasp. And we have the chance to accomplish the same thing with malaria, something I'll be pushing this Congress to fund this year.
That was U.S. President Barack Obama addressing Congress during last night's State of the Union on America's role on helping Africa. Welcome back. This is Straight Talk Africa, coming to you live from Washington. Let me come to you again, Karen. So how do we get to the issues, frankly, of winning the hearts of minds, for example, of people who come from countries where there is instability being experienced?
Well, I mean, I think it's very important in terms of the president's message. You know, I had the honor of being with him when he went to Kenya and Ethiopia, and to sit in the hall of the African Union and the speech that he gave was very inspiring. I know one of the things that he's looking forward to when he's no longer president is traveling back to Africa again. It was a bittersweet evening. I mean, it was very exciting and inspirational, but knowing that it was the last time he was going to address Congress, to me, was bittersweet. I hate to see him go because I believe he is very committed to the vision and the values that he's talked about over these last 7 years.
Now, you mentioned, of course, his speech from Addis Ababa. That is last year, I believe, in July, when
yes,
he was coming from his father's, of course, country, and his country, indeed, Kenya. You remember the message he put across?
Yes, I do.
He inspired a lot of the African people, talking about African presidents who have decided or chosen to become life presidents.
Right.
But how do you respond to people, frankly, who say, look, since 2009, with his Ghana speech, of talking about how, for example, Africa does not need strong men,
rather it needs
strong institutions.
Yep.
How do you respond to some of those people, frankly, who say he talks the talk, but he actually doesn't walk the talk so that Africa can walk the walk?
Well, I mean, it was interesting because in that speech he said that if he had the opportunity to run again, he believes that he would actually get reelected, but that was not what he wanted to do.
Right.
And I think that he has been very clear with presidents that have made efforts to change their constitutions and have run for a third term. But, you know, for me, there is always an important line. I think it's important for the United States to encourage to make its point, but we can't run the world. And that was another point that he made. And we can't be the police officer for the world, and we can't go in and build another country. So I think it's important that our message is clear.
Mm-hmm.
But when another country goes out and has a referendum and says that 80% of the people support me running for a third term, we can question the legitimacy of that referendum, but it's pretty difficult to go beyond that.
Very interesting. What about you, Bruce? You were U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe. You were U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe, and obviously the rhetoric from the White House or State Department or Capitol Hill, as far as Zimbabwe is concerned, when it comes to President Robert Gabriel Mugabe is concerned, is different.
That's right. Each country is different. Each country has its own history, its own culture, its own needs. And so we have a slightly different response to each country. The principles remain the same. We believe that a constitutional, legal transformation, peaceful transition of power is a good thing. And it allows for countries to grow, for institutions to become stronger, for economies and cultures to gain strength. In the case of Zimbabwe, we've been very, very clear about our concern about the political process there. The Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act, bipartisan piece of legislation passed in 2000, has imposed certain sanctions, restrictive measures on key players in Zimbabwe to make clear and to try to bring them to reconsider their approach to politics in that country.
Targeted sanctions, for example, you're talking about?
Travel restrictions and freezes on the ability of Americans to do business with people in Zimbabwe. Yeah.
So why should that, someone might wonder, why should that be limited to Zimbabwe? Why shouldn't those policies also be applied, for example, to countries where, frankly, you have had strong men who have been given advice and have decided to hang on to power?
Yeah. Again, I think the principles remain the same. We believe that it is healthy for a country to have regular, peaceful, constitutional, legal transitions of power. But our relationships with each country are different. And the response, there's not a one-size-fits-all, I think, that works across the continent.
I don't know whether you've been, surfing the internet or reading the social media and what have you. You should see what people are saying about the Republic of Rwanda and President Paul Kagame.
We express very clearly our deep disappointment that President Kagame has decided apparently to offer himself for an extended period in office. We don't think that that is the best approach, but that is, based on the referendum, based on President Kagame's appreciation of the situation. But let me point out that in his New Year's address, Kagame himself acknowledged that there will come a time when transformation is important. So he acknowledges the importance of this principle, that regular, peaceful, constitutional transition of power is a good thing. The question then becomes, well, when then? When is the right time for Rwanda?
After he's in power for 34 years?
When is the right time for Rwanda? That's something that the people of Rwanda have to decide.
Do you think that people who frankly say that your reaction, your statement really, was very mild, to say the least, very weak, do you think that's a very unfair, perhaps, criticism of you? Deeply disappointed?
No, I think that, in diplomatic language, that's fairly strong. And so I would obviously stand by that statement.
What does it mean in layperson's language?
Well, I think that it signals that we are concerned about the situation and that we will take a look at the broad range of our relationship and make further adjustments as may be useful or necessary.
What about your relationship with neighboring Burundi, for example?
We have very similar concerns in Burundi, and obviously we call upon the parties in Burundi to stop the violence, to sit down seriously, talk to one another, and find a way forward that works for Burundi.
Karen, do you
sincerely think that the action, for example, that the government of the United States has taken vis-a-vis Burundi is the right course to do, for example, to, in fact, remove it from AGOA?
Well, I mean, I think it's important for the United States to take a stand. I really believe in all of these issues that we're just talking about, whether you're talking about Rwanda or Zimbabwe or Burundi. Mm. What I want to see the United States do is do what we can to assist the African Union and to strengthen the African Union, for the African Union's leadership to really be able to do the type of intervention that is needed on the continent. Again, I come from a position that I am reluctant to say that the United States, and we have our own problems here. We have our own problems here with elections and voting that we then need to run around the world and tell everybody else what they're supposed to do. We make our statements. We're clear on what our principles are. But I would really like to see us focus more efforts on the African Union.
Unfortunately, the African Union, Karen, people will frankly tell you that you're talking about an institution that does not have sovereign powers, for example. It's really very weak. It's like talking about the Organization of American States. The individual countries that make the African Union, which are 54 in number, individually are extremely powerful.
Yes.
They basically pretty much control the chairperson who heads the secretariat in Addis Ababa.
I still think that the United States should do what we can to assist the African Union move beyond that and develop beyond that. Again, otherwise, you're saying that what the United States should do is to intervene in every country where we don't like the way the election turned out, or we don't like the way the individual leader has pursued to hang on to power. I don't think that's the role of the United States. I don't want to see the United States.
I understand. It's not only the United States, by the way, because African leaders talk about development partners. And in fact, there is a lot of literature that suggests that most of the elections conducted in some of these countries really run by rulers, not leaders. Those elections, frankly, are not organized for the benefit of the primary African stakeholder. They are for the benefit of the development partners, which means, frankly, development partners have a lot of clout. They can, in fact, you know, use some of the tools that they have to bring about change in those countries.
You know, I also think to the extent that the economies develop in these countries, and that's why I have focused on AGOA, I have focused on trade and economic development. To the extent that the economies develop, the middle class is expanded, those are the things that are going to help bring about change as well.
You know, it is very interesting, Bruce, because I also used to think, especially having studied a bit of political science, that in fact, if you can grow the economy, you have a large middle class, you really don't have problems.
But see what put up with it.
Yeah, but see what happened in Kenya in 2007, 2008. Kenya. See what happened in Ivory Coast after Ufuguanyi died.
Trying not to be an Afro-pessimist or an Afro-optimist, but an Afro-realist, let me ask you to take a slightly longer view of Africa. Think about Africa in 1985. How many democracies or peacefully elected governments were on the continent in 1985, or governments that represented a majority of their people? It was quite a modest number. Botswana, Mauritius, Botswana. And think about Africa today. Elections are not perfect. I mean, as the Congresswoman said, we've got our own problem with elections here. But in my view, the amount of progress that the continent has seen from 1985 to 2016 on political issues, on health issues, on economic issues, is pretty extraordinary. And so I just would like for us to step back sometimes and recognize that there has been very important progress on the continent. And with regards to the African Union, you know, the African Union, for the first time in its history, has passed a resolution saying that, look, if things don't sort themselves, if the Burundians right. can't sort things out, we're going to send 5,000 police officers right. and military people in there. And if Burundi won't accept those people, we will put sanctions on the leaders of Burundi. That's, you know, for an African institution, which has traditionally not been willing to become that involved in another country, that's a pretty extraordinary step.
Let me add to that.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about countries that have changed their constitutions and presidents that want to stay. We did have a number of successful transitions of power that took place last
Absolutely.
Year. And I think it's really important to lift that up.
Nigeria.
Everybody expected Nigeria to fall apart. There was Namibia. There was Malawi. There were several countries that had peaceful transitions of power. And I think that it just as we continue to criticize, it's very important to lift up the success.
And as we take the long view of Africa, I would like for us to also take a longer view of American support for Africans and African nations. Looking back three administrations, with AGOA, for example, that began under the Clinton administration. PEPFAR was a Bush administration mm-hmm. initiative. Mm-hmm. President Obama has retained those with the help of Congress. Of mm-hmm. course, Congress has renewed AGOA for another 10 years. PEPFAR has been doubled. President Obama has added the Young African Leader Initiative. That's a huge investment into the
right.
future. Feed the Future to improve food security.
Power
right
Africa.
Now, Ethiopia is ponying up $1 billion to address their food insecurity. Compare that to 30 years ago.
Ethiopia.
Power Africa. I mean, again, I see initiatives that have carried forward through successive and American administrations of different parties, built upon by the next administration, built upon by the people and the governments of Africa. I think the story is a better one than if you take a narrow snapshot. So let's take the longer view.
We'll come back to that later. You're tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment. But first, here is Mariam Jaro. Take it away, Mariam.
Well, thanks, Shaka. Besides the millions of viewers in the United States on television, millions more have been following the State of the Union on various social media platforms, and they had a lot to say. So still to come, we'll reveal some of the fantastic and outstanding feedback we've received from our audience through social media. But now, here is our letter of the week from a Straight Talk Africa Facebook fan who responded to our question of the week.
Omunuo Okubo Igodalo from Abuja in Nigeria writes, I think the Obama administration's policy on partnering civil society groups to strengthen democratic institutions have had the most impact on the African continent. Today, unlike some 10 years ago, many African states have a more credible electioneering process. This is a step in the right direction for Africa.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on the Voice of America. For more information, visit our website at www.voanews.com/African Beat.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. Call us now with your questions and comments. The number is 202-619-3111 and the U.S. country code is 1. Call us direct and we'll call you right back. Remember to turn down the volume on your radio or television and keep your comments brief. Now back to Straight Talk Africa.
Our foreign policy has to be focused on the threat from ISIL and al-Qaeda. But it can't stop there. For even without ISIL, even without al-Qaeda, instability will continue for decades in many parts of the world, in the Middle East, in Afghanistan and parts of Pakistan, in parts of Central America and Africa and Asia. Some of these places may become safe havens for new terrorist networks. Others will just fall victim to ethnic conflict or famine, feeding the next wave of refugees. The world will look to us to help solve these problems. And our answer needs to be more than tough talk or calls to carpet bomb civilians. That may work as a TV soundbite, but it doesn't pass muster on the world stage.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, live from Washington. That was President Obama's remarks during his State of the Union address to the U.S. Congress last night, of course. Now it's time to bring in again my colleague and social media reporter, Mariama. Take it away again, Mariama.
Well, Shaka, social media has played a big role in every election cycle since the start of the Obama presidency. 2016 and the State of the Union is no different. As President Obama enters the final year of his second term, political observers are looking at his groundbreaking policies towards Africa and the continent of his father, of course, to see if his policies live long after his presidency ends next year. This leads us to our question of the week, asking what aspect of the Obama administration's foreign policy has made the greatest contribution or impact in Africa? We'll start with reacts on Twitter, where the conversation on the State of the Union still is on. It continues. And reminding you that we are tweeting live today. Just use the hashtag VOASOTU or hashtag SOTU. And if you haven't yet, please do follow us at VOA Shaka. Speaking of it, let's go to a tweet from Moses Chambila, who writes, "The U.S.-Africa policy achieved great success to Africans, especially to economic progress, strengthen African governments, and climate change." Let's take a look at another tweet, this time from William Kukulo from Monrovia in Liberia, who writes, "Obama's Young African Leadership Program helped to produce more African entrepreneurs and professionals in other careers." And one more tweet, this time from Abby, who says, "Or his murderous drone warfare in Somalia that killed civilians more often than it did al-Shabaab." Well, let's move on to our Facebook followers, and we'll go to a Facebook comment from Brian Nizeye from Kampala in Uganda, who writes, "President Obama's effort to improve democracy in Africa by criticizing African presidents who don't want to leave power has been a contribution. I'm talking about the likes of Pierre Nkurunziza, Robert Mugabe, and our own Yoweri Museveni." Shaka and guests, your take on these comments.
Very interesting. Your reaction?
Well, I thought the comments were very interesting, especially the one that talked about the young African leaders. Mm-hmm. I think that has had a tremendous impact, and it's been very exciting in Washington and on the continent of Africa. When I've traveled to many countries, I've met the Yali, as we call them, the Yali leaders, as well as I've hosted a number of them on the Capitol. And I have to tell you, as I've spoken to the group of Yali leaders, mm-hmm. I look out at the group and I say, boy, all of you could be leaders of business, the civil society, you know, presidents, prime ministers. It's very exciting.
It's incredible, of course. I recall, of course, with Nostalgia, the opportunity and the honor that you bestowed upon me interacting with the Yali students on Capitol Hill. And, of course, I was also invited to the University of Virginia, interacted with so many others. Mm-hmm. We have since hosted many, many of them for the last 2 years. I think perhaps that's the future for Africa.
Absolutely.
I think you have a point. Mariama, do you have more feedback for us, please?
Absolutely, Shaka. We'll move on to a posting from David Onserio Monda in L.A. He's actually Kenyan, but he lives in Los Angeles at the moment. He says, "I think President Obama's initiatives on renewable energy, especially the Power Africa program, have had the most impact. The range and scope of people reached is massive." Let's go to a comment, this time from Philippe Mwanza, the founding member of My Africa Zambia. He's based in the capital, in the Zambian capital, Lusaka. He says, "I think the Young African Leaders Initiative, of course, we just touched on that, or the YALI program, has been fantastic and very helpful to many young Africans. However, the African Growth and Opportunity Act was seriously failed, and it's a shame to Africa. That is all I have to say." Shaka and guests, I'm not sure it failed everywhere, but I'm certainly interested in hearing comments. I'm sure there are places that took plenty of advantage when it came to AGOA as well.
Your reaction, Mr. Ambassador?
I think we have to admit that AGOA has focused too much on commodities. Petroleum has been a huge percentage of AGOA. And that's one of the reasons why this administration, going forward into the next year, is looking at industrialization
as a major focus for our economic and commercial and investment work on the continent. Mm-hmm. African economies are fully capable of adding value to their exports, and I think that's a vital way for them to go forward. I hope that will then allow people to take better advantage of AGOA. And it relates to Power Africa, because without reliable and reasonably priced access to electrical power, industrialization becomes very important. And I think the Obama administration's push on Power Africa is very important. It aims to reach 60 million households and enterprises in Africa, about $7 billion worth of funding from the U.S. government, which is leveraged about $20 billion of private sector funding. So it really is an exciting new initiative.
Interesting.
Let me make a comment about AGOA as well. When AGOA passed, we realized that it was really a shell. There's many other pieces of legislation that needed to follow to assist African countries reach the level of capacity where they could actually trade more with the United States. And so trade facilitation, having African countries work together, addressing regional economic communities. So there are several things that we're doing, because to interact with the U.S. market, you really have to be able to export on a very massive level. And so I think that there's more work we can do. From the African perspective, we're really pushing each African country to develop their own strategy on how to interact with AGOA.
I think the problem is governance issues more on the ground than from Washington. Mariama, thank you so much for your contributions. And of course, we'll be waiting to hear from you again next week.
Absolutely. And to touch on AGOA, it actually got renewed last year for another 10 years. So I hope the African countries have learned certainly from certain mistakes before and are hopefully going to take full advantage in the next 10 years and just exploit the hell out of it, I would say. Well, that will do it for today's social media segment. Just a reminder that we appreciate all the feedback, whether it's in social media form or using other means to communicate to us. Please keep them coming. If you are a new fan, just drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is africatv@voanews.com, or post your comment on our Facebook page. Just enter the keywords Straight Talk Africa. Be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com, or you can join our YouTube channel. Sign up to VOA TV to Africa, and don't forget to follow us on Twitter at VOA Shaka. A reminder that the show is streaming live every Wednesday. Go to the VOA Straight Talk Africa TV program page on our website, or simply watch us live on your mobile device. Just download the VOA mobile app. Now let's take a look at what's on tap for next week's program.
Next week on Straight Talk Africa, peace talks between the Burundian government and opposition groups were postponed this week with no word on when they may resume. We'll discuss the crisis in Burundi. That's next week, right here on Straight Talk Africa.
Yes, let's go to the lifeline of the show, and I gather that we do have a call from Tanzania. Good evening, Ndugu. You are most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Hello, how are you there?
Yes, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. How is Washington?
Washington is fine. Now, of course, this happens to be winter, but we are fine.
Good. My name is Emmanuel. I'm calling from Tanzania.
Mm-hmm.
My comment is, actually, I'm part of the yearly 2014.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Then I really like the way President Obama is helping Africa to move from one stage to another going forward. But my worry is this is very personal to the president. And when he leaves the office, my worry is, will it be a continuation or will live with him? That's my worry. Is he having a plan to make it an operating institution, or just with him? That's my comment.
Thank you very much. I think
that's something that I'm worried about as well. You know, with some of President Obama's initiatives, what we're doing on the Hill is passing legislation that actually puts them into statute. So it doesn't matter what president is around. We've done that with Feed the Future. We've done that with Power Africa. There's more for us to do. We haven't quite finished on either one of those accounts. But I'm concerned about Yali as well, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to do the same. Now, having said that, I do know that he plans to be very active when he leaves office. So it's my hope, if we're not able to pass the legislation to make these programs permanent, that he continues them as an ex-president.
You think it could be pretty much like join the league of perhaps the U.S. Peace Corps?
Yeah, that was
introduced by JFK.
Well, one of the things that they were proposing for Yali this year is to have Americans go to Africa. So I absolutely hope that it's that way. I think it's such an impressive program with incredible potential.
Very interesting. Now, Bruce, we have to go for a break and then we'll come back. A reminder that you are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. If you wish to participate in our discussion, please call us at 202-619-3111. U.S. country code is 1. We'll continue our discussion in a moment.
Once again, let's take a look at the State of the Union Address. About 130 foreign ambassadors to the U.S. attended this year's event. The diplomatic corps will fill designated seats on both sides of the chamber. Congress has welcomed foreign ambassadors to attend its floor activities since the 1840s. When new House and Senate chambers were built in the 1850s, they included diplomatic galleries for foreign ambassadors.
We are able to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
If you like today's show, please write and tell us what you think or give us some suggestions. Be sure to tell us what station you're tuned into. Our address, Straight Talk Africa, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or send us an email at africatv@voanews.com. Log on to our website at voaafrica.com. Or post your comments on Facebook. Keywords, Straight Talk Africa.
That's how we stop the spread of Ebola in West Africa. Our military, our doctors, our development workers, they were heroic. They set up the platform that then allowed other countries to join in behind us and stamp out that epidemic. Hundreds of thousands, maybe a couple million lives were saved.
Welcome back, and that was President Obama on the United States helping West African nations to stop the spread of Ebola. Well, of course, this is Straight Talk Africa coming to you live from Washington. Let me come to you, Bruce. You know, we had a great party here. 2014, was it? The U.S. Africa Summit.
Leadership Summit.
Should we expect another opportunity about that? The Chinese have been doing plenty, my friend. They just had one, in fact, in South Africa recently, in Johannesburg, which was probably the sixth.
I cannot predict exactly what the White House is planning at this point. That would be foolish of me. I know that the commitment to deepening and broadening our engagement with Africa is real. It's represented in this administration and in the previous two administrations. Again, I'm taking the longer view here. I think we're likely to see something that focuses more on deepening business, economic, investment ties between the United States and Africa.
What about you, Karen? What about from the view of the Capitol Hill?
Well, I'll tell you, many people in the Capitol, especially those of us that were involved in the summit, would really like to see the entire thing happen again. But what I'm hearing is similar, is that it would probably be more similar to the business forum that happened as opposed to the full two- or three-day summit with all of the leaders. Mm-hmm. So we are looking forward to that, though.
Interesting. Let me take you back to your collaboration with the African Union. You're right. The African Union, in fact, has accomplished a lot of positive things along the way. You know, in particular, when you think about the fact that the African Union, for example, does not recognize any general or colonel or sergeant who seizes power with AK-47.
Right.
Why can't you talk to them to also figure out a way, frankly, of making sure that if somebody steals an election, rigs an election in order to hang on to power, they can do exactly the same thing, because that seems to be the moral equivalent of military coups these days.
Right. I mean, I think those discussions, I know, have happened and will continue to happen with the African Union, but there also might be other ways that our country can support the African Union so that they can put some teeth behind that when that type of statement is made. I mean, for example, when the coup in Mali happened and there was the need for troops to come in, you know, the Malians had to call in the French. The African Union wasn't quite ready to intervene, and they certainly did come along. But I think there's a variety of ways that the United States can help to shore up the infrastructure and capacity of the African Union.
I gather that we have to go back to the lifeline of the show, which are the telephone callers. I have a call from Nigeria, I gather. Good evening. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Yeah, good evening.
How are you? How are you?
I'm very fine.
Yes, please.
Okay. My question still goes to the presidency and talking about the election that should take place at Uganda. Why would they not allow the president to conduct? Why is it that the president wants to conduct an independent election? Hello? Because, you know, hello?
Hello?
Yeah, I mean, you talked about the post that came from Harvard University. Fine. Education is not all about the certificate or maybe the school you come from. Yes, I so much respect a school like Harvard University, but it's also about reasoning. Let's do what is just and fair. You can see the change in Nigeria. You know, one of our best governors now, Fashola, which is an outstanding man, he didn't pass the four shores of Africa. He schooled in Nigeria, yeah, and he's so excellent. He did what is just and fair. We all Nigerians, we deserve the best. So let's just remove all those talk of maybe after 30 years. I mean, for God's sake, these Uganda people, they want what is right, they deserve what is best. Let them conduct an independent independent election in that country, and let us have what is the same as happened in Nigeria. Let them just, like, imitate that. You know, Uganda deserves the best. After we deserve the best. So let them remove the issue of the power, the nuclear power, you know, just to spoil the things on ground. Mr. Amitin has said what is right, but the man from Harvard is just trying to divert the question, and I mean, he could not even answer him properly.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I have to say, frankly, that it's been very, very difficult for me to understand exactly what he's saying, but I think I get a fairly good sense. He talks about how, for example, Nigeria was able to get it for the first time because it had a credible electoral commission, obviously under Professor Jega. Nigeria made wonders, you know, since, frankly, independence, October 1st, 1960. For the first time, they got it right. And hopefully it will influence the sub-region in terms of going democratic. And see, West Africa, when you think about it, or actually when you look at it in the context of the continent, seems to be doing very well in the democratization process. But he also raised another question, which was connected with Uganda. He talked about how Uganda, for example, the government rejected a request from the opposition and civil society for fundamental electoral reforms. The only reform that they were able to do was to provide a new name, give a name to the Electoral Commission, call it an independent Electoral Commission. And he obviously refers to a previous show where a government, actually a spokesperson who goes to school at Harvard, was not able to answer that question for him. Your reaction, Mr. Ambassador?
I think Nigeria does show the way. This most recent election was a model, really. But as you point out, it took Nigeria several tries to get there. And I think, as I said earlier, each country has its own history, its own culture, its own path towards the ideal of a transparent, credible, fair election. But ultimately, you know, what we want is for people to be able to vote, to have their votes counted, and for the whole process to be done peacefully. And in Uganda, you know, we are concerned about the closure of space for the opposition and for civil society and for freedom of expression. That closure will not make Uganda stronger, quite the opposite. And so we call on all parties in Uganda to respect the law, to allow for peaceful discourse, campaigning, media, and to move the country forward in a peaceful way.
Would it be fair, Karen, when you look at a country like Uganda, you look at Zimbabwe, you look at Rwanda, you look at Cameroon, you look at Burundi, you look at most of these countries, frankly, don't you find it very interesting that you have a ruling party that is fused with the state? Basically, there's no difference between the ruling party and the state. The two are fused. If true, how do you expect those countries, frankly, to conduct an election that can be free, fair, credible, and transparent?
Well, you know, I mean, I think it is a process of time. So we have to look at the African countries who have had maybe 50 years of independence. Now, the United States has been in existence for over 230 years. Mm-hmm. Look at where we were 50 years into the existence of the United States. We went through many years of civil war, tons of corruption, lots of problems, to where we are today, which frankly we're struggling, and a lot of folks of color are struggling, to not lose our right to vote here in the United States. We still don't have a perfect democracy. We've been ruled by one party for a long time. We've gone through long periods with that, where one party controlled the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives, and I certainly hope that we don't go back to that. But I think that it's a process of development, and I think ultimately what decides it, as our economy developed, we demanded much higher standards. And to me, I think that's where our focus needs to be. I don't think we're supposed to run around the world and tell everybody how their democracy should function. We should talk about our values. We should provide an example of the United States. But ultimately, change has to happen internally.
Well, the problem is that policy seems to be selective, because when it comes to Zimbabwe, it seems to me that the United States thinks it has a right to tell Mr. Mugabe about that.
We're not telling Mr. Mugabe what to do. We're simply making clear that we're concerned about the future of his country, and our response is A, B, C, and D, and it's up to Mr. Mugabe and his government to decide what's best for them and his country.
Now,
the United States was very lucky because you did have at least a private media. Someone might call it, of course, independent, but there was the media. And even during Jim Crow and what have you in the South, even Martin Luther King Jr. with his organization, and whatever, at least you had the cameras there.
Well, you know what? I mean, we could talk about our media right now that only seems to be covering one subject and one person when it comes to this presidential election, okay? So there's still, you know, a lot to be desired.
Unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally. On that note, thanks to our distinguished guests, Karen Bass, U.S. House of Representatives for the U.S. State of California, and Ambassador Bruce Wharton, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Thanks to our affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners, we thank you for tuning in. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning, it's Daybreak Africa with James Abate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.